Well, welcome everybody on Valentine's Day. What better to do than listen to Jeff talking about the good life? I'm Richard Layard, and I have had the great good fortune to see Jeff in action over the last 35 years on three major and completely different topics. The first was on stagflation. Jeff was very young at that time, and he looked even younger. Actually, he still looks pretty young. But he did incredibly important work on stagflation, and the result was that he became a full professor at Harvard at the age of 27, the same day that the same thing happened to Larry Summers, as he reminded me just now. The second topic was post-communist reform and transition. And I saw the extraordinary success which Jeff had in advising the Polish government on their reform plans, which led to his first lot of Robin's lectures here, and the much more difficult task of advising the Russian government on their reform plans. But I must say, it was absolutely awesome. I was in Moscow for quite some time with Jeff, just awesome to see how he went about that. And then the third issue is well-being, nearer to what we're doing today. For the last 6 years, Jeff and John Helliwell and I have been the co-editors of the World Happiness Report, but the World Happiness Report was invented by Jeff, just one of his many remarkable inventions. So over this whole period, Jeff has actually always been exactly the same. Very clever, very passionate, and incredibly well organized, not only organizing himself, but everybody else. I think I can say that when Jeff asks you to do something, you know that he already knows the answer, and it isn't no. He is extraordinarily persuasive. So last Monday, yesterday, we had a great lecture on Jeff's vision for how to rebuild economics as the science of well-being, incredibly important general point. Today he's going to talk about six specific issues that arise along the way, one of which, he tells me, is gender equality. What more suitable for Valentine's Day? Jeff. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We go back a long way, and I can only tell you it's a lot of fun because Richard is not only a great economist, but a great friend. We've had a lot of adventures, and I hope 26 years from now you'll invite me back for the next Robbins cycle because it's really a joy to be here. We were talking yesterday about well-being and about economics and the connection of the two and how economics can really do a better job of connecting with what we have learned from the sages as well as from modern science about human well-being, what I call moral science as the science of well-being, and how by grounding economics in moral science and in a more accurate anthropology of human nature, we can get better results. Economics should be a results-oriented field. It's not, in my view, a field of pure study, pure theory, aesthetics. There are many fields like that. They're quite wonderful. It is not a field of pure mathematics. It's a field to do things. And I likened it yesterday to being at a medical school that says we study disease, but we don't really much care whether the disease is cured or not. Economics to say we study economic behavior, but it's not our point of view to take end goals in mind and to aim for them is equally a mistake. So I argued yesterday that we can do a lot better than that. We can define human well-being with some precision including taking into account diversity. So that is part of human well-being, that our personalities differ, our skills differ, our tastes differ, and a good society will, of course, accommodate and reflect that. Part of human good is our own choices of building. So societies that give freedom to choose one's life course is itself a good from all that we know about human well-being. But we know a lot more about human well-being as well. We know about the need for social relations. We know about the need of meeting basic physiological needs. We know about the suffering that comes from hunger or disease unchecked or mental illness unchecked. And these are things that should be front and center for economic reasoning. So today, I want to follow in that analysis and talk about what we have learned about human nature and its relations to the capacity to achieve pro-social outcomes. Part of the news is good. Part of the news is that we have built into us genetically through an evolutionary process and then abetted by social, historical, cultural processes, the capacity to identify the human good and the capacity to help to promote it. We also have built into us a lot that can go haywire. And human nature was not designed for the teleology of the human good. We are designed by evolutionary processes that can have some quite perverse outcomes as well. And we need to understand ourselves better. We need to understand human nature more accurately. And that means drawing heavily from evolutionary biology, from psychology, from neuroscience, from sociology, from other fields to understand human nature, build a more accurate anthropology, and use that to understand how institutions, markets, collective action, social dynamics can go wrong and how we can help them go right to do a better job of meeting human needs. So that's the idea tonight. And in particular, I want to discuss six things that can go very wrong in this process after reviewing a little bit about why we have any hope in the first place. So morality is feasible in the first place, I would argue, because we're not Hobbesian in nature. We are not solitary individuals that got together from a life that is short, nasty, and brutish, and we have to give all power to a Leviathan to get anything right. We are not what Hobbes claimed, that all of our instincts for the good are unmanageable unless they're controlled by an outside sovereign. We have internal impulses and dynamics that help us to find the way. And what Aristotle said about this, like many things that Aristotle said 2,300 years ago, was very wise, very pithy, and very current. He said, man is by nature a social animal. An individual who is unsocial naturally and not accidentally is either beneath our notice or more than human. Society is something that precedes the individual. Anyone who either cannot lead the common life or is so self-sufficient as not to need to and therefore does not partake of society is either a beast or a god. And it's striking in our methodology of individualism in a disciplinary way where we start with N people and they have a resource vectors and then they start to interact with each other. We start with individuals and we build up an economic equilibrium in the basic economics. When you read the politics of Aristotle, he says society precedes the individual, just as it says here. It's a rather striking point when you first read it from a modern perspective. He says, just like you wouldn't say that the hand and the foot exist before the body, they're all parts of the body. The body comes first, and then there are the individual parts to it. And this, I think, is an incredibly valuable corrective for us, because we always methodologically start the other way, and we miss, therefore, a lot of basic truths. Now, to my mind, the best understanding of human nature comes from the intersection of evolutionary biology, neuroscience, and psychology. And all three of these fields are making tremendous advances very rapidly. So what we understand about human nature will continue to evolve. We will continue to deepen our understanding. Psychology allows for experimentation, for analysis, controlled observation of human behavior. Neuroscience shows fundamentally the biological pathways that determine behavior, and we're in the most stunning breakthrough period of neuroscientific knowledge, ever. Even 50 years ago, neuroscience was deemed to be almost impossible to understand how the brain actually functioned, and psychology, therefore, had an extreme behaviorist view, which is don't understand what's happening inside the head, just look at external behaviors. We've abandoned that, fortunately, because our techniques for understanding neuroscientific underpinnings of behavior are growing very quickly. And similarly, our perspective through evolutionary biology, which really started in 1859 with Darwin, with Origin of Species, but even more with The Descent of Man in 1871, and Darwin's many hypotheses about emotional pathways, about facial expressions, about sexual selection, and about group selection, turned out to be incredibly fruitful for modern scientific thought. And a lot of the latest evolutionary psychology and evolutionary biological insights to human nature trace back to pithy sentences of Darwin from the original studies. And as I quoted yesterday, Darwin says, man still bears in his bodily frame the indelible stamp of his lowly origin. So we're carrying some very deep traits from the evolutionary path of hominids, which date back about 5 million years, and from the great ape species, which date back even earlier when we divided off the great ape chain from chimpanzees roughly at that point, and that come to us to modern evolution of Homo sapiens from 200,000 years ago till now. It's clear that cooperation is part of a genetic imprint. There is voluminous evidence to this point now that evolution created bases of human cooperation. Humans have been social animals throughout the period of modern evolution. We've been social animals from our common ancestor with chimpanzees about 6 million years ago. That sociality developed and deepened tremendously in the course of hominid evolution, and especially in the last few 100,000 years, and especially with the final leaps of language and culture of Homo sapiens in the last 50,000 years. But clearly an evolutionary course imprinted in our common genetic makeup is real and part of that. We also know a lot more than we did just 25 years ago about possible neuroscientific pathways of moral channels. And basically, neuroscientists have been sticking our heads in MRIs for the last 25 years and getting imaging of which parts of the brain light up when you're cheating, when you're lying, when you're challenged with cooperation, when you're playing a prisoner's dilemma, when you're feeling guilty, and so forth. And there are consistent patterns of pathways that identify linkages between emotions and cognitive executive reasoning of the prefrontal cortex. There are parts of the brain that light up during cheating, parts of the brain that light up during guilty episodes. They're part of the brain that light up during shame. And, of course, there's a great deal more to be learned about this, but there's a lot of scientific base that simply did not exist until very recently. One of the key ideas of the last 40 years has been the idea of mirror pathways or mirror neurons, which make us feel pain when someone else is in pain. And that's a quick automatic response. It has certain neuronal clear cognates and pathways. It's something that Adam Smith talks about in The Theory of Moral Sentiments, also David Hume, about the natural instincts of sympathy. Adam Smith observes the physical pain that one feels in watching someone else suffer physical pain. Those are clear, demarcated pathways now, of course, still with certain uncertainties, but they play a huge role in human sympathy and in human empathy and in the capacity to understand what a counterpart is feeling. They're vital for the basic mechanics of sociality. There are obviously pathways of nurturing an infant, and the maternal instinct has very powerful hormonal and neurotransmitter pathways. And if you take one of the most powerful of these that has been studied, oxytocin, we know, and many of you may have read about it, if you have a normal experiment of prisoner's dilemma behavior, and you spray a little oxytocin into the room, you can boost the cooperation levels that result in the game. There are hormonal pathways that are invoked, and certain neuroscientists have made ingenious arguments about how pathways of mother-to-child care, for example, may be co-opted at certain moments for heroic behavior of saving strangers. Professor Pfaff at Rockefeller University wrote a book a few years ago about the neurobiological pathways of the golden rule, in essence, arguing that the maternal child pathways are grabbed because that's how biology works, or evolutionary processes work, that existing pathways can be taken for other purposes, and one of the purposes is the altruistic actions vis-a-vis strangers. There is a lot of and growing evidence about emotional pathways which underpin moral behavior. It hurts most people to cheat, a physical hurt. There is guilt aversion, and there are guilt emotional responses. Some people do an adequate job of overcoming them, but in general, it's not free. It's costly. And that is not necessarily built into the, in fact, it's surely not built into the prisoner's dilemma structured as a game, but it may be built into the reason why there's more cooperation than the most basic game theory suggests. And those guilt pathways have been identified as involving the supplementary motor area, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, and the insula as parts of the brain that consistently are part of lighting up a guilt pathway. Similarly, the dopamine reward processing pathways of the brain seem to be very much invoked when altruistic actions are undertaken. We talk in the economics literature about the warm glow effect, that you do something nice because you get a physical response, and it turns out being nice to others can produce a flush of dopamine in our brains, which is literally the reward center for behavior. So we give ourselves a good shot of dopamine when we feel good about what we've done. And that is another kind of neurobiological pathway. There is a lot of advance in understanding theory of mind, which is the concept of even from a baby a few days old, showing evidence of understanding that when they're relating to a counterpart, they know that counterpart is somehow thinking about something. And there are ingenious tricks of getting infants to suck harder or to flash their eyes or to point their eyes towards a direction, giving evidence that they have a theory of mind of the counterpart. And that's important for us in our social interactions, that we understand you're watching, you're not just staring at me, well, maybe you are hoping, thinking that you're someplace else, but you're possibly wondering what I'm thinking staring at you. And because of that, we are able to have more complex interactions that I kind of expect you to give me B at the cost of C, because I'm going to do the same thing, because we're going to meet later for a drink, and if you really mess me up right now, I'm not going to be too happy about that. And all that theory of mind has to have biological pathways. It can't just happen other than through the mechanics of our synapses. And that is being sorted. And similarly, the role of language is obviously crucial for cooperation. I think the story of Babel is probably about the most powerful of the stories in Genesis. We have a very hard time cooperating with people we literally do not understand, who speak a different language, who are barbarians, to use the favorite term for someone who doesn't speak our language. And this is also a key part of the neuroscience of cooperation as it is unfolding. So if you take these two aspects of biology underpinning morality and evolution underpinning biology, the evolutionary biologists have gone to work to ask a basic question. How can moral sentiments, how can moral pathways evolve? Are they evolutionarily stable? If a society or if a species evolves in a way of high cooperation, can that be successfully invaded, in the language of evolutionary game theory, by a cheater? Is it stable to have cooperators? Why does this question arise? Because if you go back to the social dilemma that was at the core of the moral challenge yesterday, there's a reason not to cooperate. The reason is that if you cooperate and I don't, I'm better off. I gain the advantage of your cooperation and I save the costs of my own cooperation. And so the question for biology is not, unlike for economics, the question for economics is cooperation a good thing? How do you promote it? The question for biology is how can it arise in an evolutionary process? And how can it arise if cheaters gain something from cheating? Now, in all evolutionary biology studies, there's a basic model. The basic model is that individuals in the species interact. Those that are successful in some sense get the bigger prize, get to reproduce more. They survive more, they have more food, they have more access to sex, they have the harems. Whatever it is, they're the ones that are reproductively more successful, so their genes transmit. And so if we're playing a dyadic prisoner's dilemma game and we say to each other, let's cooperate, it's for the good of both of us, and then we play and you cooperate, and I cheat, I get the kids. Because you're a nice guy, but you're a sucker. And I end up with the prize. I grab the B from you. You end up with minus C, and you just can't get a date. Whereas I have the big prize, and I have more evolutionary success. That's the basic framework of evolutionary dynamics of cooperation. The question is it possible to have an evolution in which nice people finish first, not finish last? It's not asking the question whether being nice or being moral is a good thing or a bad thing, whether it's deontologically given, whether God wants it that way or not. The question is, in an evolutionary dynamic process, can nice people finish first? And the starting point is not so easy, because nice guys, nice people, are taken advantage of by cheaters. And so how can it be, even though it's better for everybody to be nice, how, in fact, can that be an evolutionary process? And there have been five types of answers given to that, and I want to review those quickly. The first is kin selection. The second is what's called direct reciprocity, that I'm nice to you because I expect you to be nice to me in the future. The third is indirect reciprocity. I'm nice to you because I want it to be known that I'm a nice guy so that when I go to make another transaction later on, people say, hey, that's a nice guy coming over here. We can cooperate, so I want a decent reputation. A fourth is the nice people go off to one place. They self-organize. We're the nice community. Assholes can stay out. But we're the nice community, and therefore we can have evolutionary success because in our community people behave themselves, they're moral, and if you are immoral, you're ostracized. Because in evolutionary models, in iterated prisoner's dilemma models, often there is an implicit assumption of random mixing of the population. But in this case of network evolution of cooperation, the idea is that there are systematic geographical patterns. It's done on a graph rather than on a uniform mixing of the evolution of cooperation. So it's a kind of self-selection process. And then the fifth and extremely important idea, the one that Darwin had in 1871, the one that was popular for a while, then attacked heatedly by Dawkins in the selfish gene mode, and now is making a strong comeback, is the idea that good behavior could result from multi-level selection. Multi-level selection means that natural selection operates at the level of individuals, but also at the level of groups. And that seems a little contrary to evolutionary thought. If it operates at the level of groups, it's intuitive why good behavior might work, because good behavior is good for the society. So things which lead to patriotic responses, which lead to altruism within a community, make the community strong. And if selection is operating at the level of a community, at the level of a group, then it's not surprising that traits in behavior that are conducive to group camaraderie, to group success, to mutual respect, to trust, and so forth would be selected. But the usual idea is that, again, those who cooperate within the group are suckered by those who are wily cheaters. And so from an evolutionary point of view, group selection can only apply if somehow the processes of reproductive success operate not only at the level of individuals that are making these behavioral decisions, but at the level of whole groups. And I'll discuss that in a moment. It's extremely important. So the first idea of how altruism or cooperation or playing the cooperative card in a prisoner's dilemma or choosing to support a public good in an end-person social dilemma could arise was kin selection. And the idea of kin selection is a gene which favors cooperation can spread within a family because it makes sense from the point of view of genetic success for an individual like myself to take an altruistic action, even at my own cost, for a child, for example, because the child likely carries the same, not because the child carries the gene, that behavior becomes embedded in the population because the gene which marks for it is successful by having a parent, for example, have the genetically based instinct to save their children, even at their own cost, because that causes more success in the reproduction of that trait. And the author of that idea was William Hamilton, professor of evolutionary biology at Oxford. And he made a famous equation. And the famous equation is going back to the B and the C, the benefits and the costs, and a measure of genetic relatedness, little r. And what he said was that altruism could take hold in a related community if the benefits of altruism, for instance, I incur a cost C so that my relative gets a benefit B, as long as the genetic proximity with whom I'm cooperating has a closeness R. Now, R is essentially a measure of how many genes we share. And so R is a half for a child, and it's a quarter for a grandchild, and it's a quarter for an aunt or an uncle to a niece or a nephew, for example. So the idea is that if there are genetic traits that call for altruistic responses to a kin, not in general. In general, R is zero in a society. That equation would never hold. But being nice to your kin can hold if I can give a benefit more than twice the cost to a child, even though incurring that cost is bad for my genetic propagation. Giving the benefit to a child that shares half my genes on average means that that trait is more likely to propagate. So a very simple idea, and the idea was that we get cooperation in human society because people evolve to help their kin. And it's not surprising, it is true, that there is more cooperation within family relations and more heroic acts of parents saving children and so forth than in the general population. And this idea became a cornerstone for cooperation. And biologists spent 30 years trying to test the R, B, and C relationship across dozens, hundreds of species. If one animal in a community gives a warning call against a predator, that is an altruistic act because the eagle looks at the muskrat and pounces, and it could be a suicidal act that saves the rest of the community. And so the question is, did that evolve because it was propagated within a kin relationship? One big problem with this, we cooperate massively with people who are not our relatives. And so while this was a good theory for certain kinds of cooperation, and it was taken for a while to be a strong theory for high levels of cooperation in species like wasps and bees that have a very high degree of cooperative behavior. It doesn't apply self-evidently to the real questions that we're after beyond small kin groups. It doesn't seem to apply to the mix of genes in hunter-gatherer societies or Paleolithic societies, and the leap from this to broader kinds of cooperation are not easy to identify. That led to a second idea, really the economist's idea of iterated game theory. And the idea of the iterated prisoner's dilemma is that in a one-time play of the prisoner's dilemma, if you don't cheat, you're a little bit of a sucker or you have a very deep guilt pathway. But from the point of view of maximizing your output, your dominant strategy is to cheat. But if the game is going to be repeated, even probabilistically on an open-ended basis, we're going to be neighbors across the way. And if on the first day I cheat, it's going to lead to a miserable relationship in the future. And so one reason why we might cooperate, and I may decide to be nice to you and you nice to me, is that we're going to see each other over the fence tomorrow. And again, and again, and again, we have to do business with each other on an open-ended basis. If ever the last day comes and I'm moving, that's that I'm going to cheat. But if we have an ongoing open relationship, then the logic is that that can support cooperation merely by a kind of trigger strategy logic that says, if I cheat, you're not going to cooperate with me again, and that that's a logical equilibrium. So in evolutionary game theory, it's possible to ask whether in social organisms that have repeated interactions, whether altruistic or cooperative or moral genes could propagate. The answer is yes, even if they're not related, as long as there's continuing ongoing play between two individuals. So we can have a theory of unrelated, non-kin cooperation as long as it's iterated, because then we support the moral outcomes by the idea of direct reciprocity. I'm nice to you, you're nice to me, because we want to have an ongoing relationship in the future. And that kind of equilibrium can be fully supported by genetic evolution. The equation is almost the same. Instead of R being the kin relationship, now there's a W, which is the probability that there will be a subsequent encounter. And this means that in a one-shot game, W is zero, and this equation could never hold, and therefore cooperation among strangers can't take place. But if W is high enough, if the probability is one, for example, that we're going to continue to interact, all cooperation needs to be evolutionarily successful is that B would be greater than C. So this is the idea of direct reciprocity, and it's given rise to various behavioral strategies that have proven to be robust and successful in explaining behavior and also in choosing strategies in game situations. And I mentioned tit for tat yesterday. Tit for tat says start out in a cooperative mode, and if your counterpart ever cheats, then switch to non-cooperation. And that is a strategy that's quite robust, actually, and can sustain a lot of cooperation. Knowing that the opponent is playing that also tells you keep cooperating. The problem with that kind of strategy is you can get into that trap I talked about yesterday, that cooperation breaks down, maybe because of mistake, and then the two sides never trust each other again. And so there's an idea called generous tit-for-tat, which is if we do have a breakdown of relations, with a certain probability, it makes sense to revive the relations again. And then there's a third closely related strategy called win-stay, lose-shift strategy. And that's also a cooperative strategy that says we'll cooperate if I'm either If we're either mutually cooperative or I'm in a situation where I cheat and you're cooperative, either of those, I'm a winner, and I'll just keep doing what I did before. And if I lose in the sense that I cooperate, you cheat, or we both cheat so we don't gain anything, we have a loss, then we should each shift our strategy. That's also evolutionarily stable and quite powerful. Well, that's fine for dyadic relations between ongoing partners in a long-term relationship, but our cooperation needs to be more expanded than that, and it is observed to be among strangers, even in short-term play. And that gave rise to the idea of indirect reciprocity. We have brains to remember that person's not a nice person. And the idea is that that gives us the capacity to sustain even a higher level of moral success among relative strangers by reputation. And this also can be sustained in an evolutionary logic, in an evolutionary game. If people with bad reputations are unsuccessful in propagating their traits of non-cooperativeness. And of course, you need a quite sophisticated mental apparatus to be able to retain a memory of who did what bad to you and have that also as a trigger for action. But the human brain is certainly capable of that. We spend an enormous amount of time on our reputation. As Groucho Marx famously said, the key to success in life is sincerity. If you can fake that, you have it made. That's really about reputational equilibrium. So here the idea is that you can show in a dynamic evolutionary game context, the same kind of relationship, but now Q stands for yet another number between 0 and 1. It's the probability of knowing someone's good or bad reputation in the particular evolutionary process. I'm referring to one mathematical study of all of these options. Now, this is the one that Adam Smith emphasized. In The Theory of Moral Sentiments, he says, why do people behave themselves? He talked about natural sympathy. He talked about essentially mirror neurons. He talked about the impartial spectator as a measure of behavior. But he said that the thing people really crave is respect and good reputation. Not everybody in this society, he said, not the rich, not the powerful, they don't necessarily crave that, and they don't show much moral behavior. But for most people in society, Smith said, it was indirect reciprocity. It was the reputation that was absolutely crucial. I mentioned network reciprocity as the idea that as hard as it is for good behavior to instill itself through evolutionary processes, if the good behaviors are not randomly meeting the bad behaviors but are kind of isolating themselves formally on a graph so that there's a geographic structure to this, that also can support the evolution cooperative behavior. But the last one is probably the most important for us, and it is absolutely a worrisome idea. And this is an idea that was championed by David Sloan Wilson for the last 25 years, a biologist who said that group selection is a reality because humans evolved in small bands that faced limited ecological prospects, and therefore either through war or replacement of other bands were in competition for survival at a group level. And this was taken as a kind of a heresy by the selfish gene advocates for a while until it was realized that it's fully consistent with the gene itself being selfish in terms of selection based on the success of intergenerational propagation of gene types, that doesn't change, but that the logic of group selection works if groups are relatively intact, if reproduction is relatively within the group, and if there's lots of intergroup competition. And under those circumstances, you can have what is now called multi-level or two-level, in this case, selection, natural selection, that there is selection among the individuals of a society, and there the shirkers or the cheaters may still trick or beat the cooperators within the group because they end up with more resources and more success. But the groups that harbor larger numbers of cooperators and therefore are better at war or better at hunting or better at survival relative to the non-cooperating groups essentially replace the non-cooperating groups in ecological niches. And one mathematical representation of that is the same as before, that it depends on the ratio of the benefits to the cost of an altruistic act. But in this case, it depends on the size of the maximum group and the number of groups that are competing with each other. In the particular group selection model here, the idea is that successful groups expand in size because they have reproductive success, and after a certain point of size, they divide into groups, and because of their relative success, they replace a loser group. And in this sense, groups that harbor lots of cooperators can end up replacing groups that don't have cooperators within them and therefore don't have as much genetic success. Well, if groups are very large when they're competing with each other, it's harder for group selection to work because the intra-group rivalry between the cooperators and the non-cooperators becomes the dominant play. So if the maximum size of a group is very large, then group selection is not very powerful. And similarly, if the number of groups that have their ecological niches is very large, then group selection can be more powerful. A successful group can imprint itself with the cooperation. So this is the kind of idea of group selection. There's a very dark implication of this, though, and that is that we are patriotic so we can kill somebody else. We're patriotic, we are loyal, we are cooperative because we are then more successful in wiping out other groups. And to the extent that this is a dominant or the dominant reason why cooperation can get implanted, it is an argument about our split human nature, which is people that can be as sweet as can be to their neighbors can be murderers to the group across the river. And intuitively to me, that unfortunately makes a lot of sense because we need an explanation for moral behavior of why it's pervasive, why cooperation is what it is, and why we are also so bloody-minded at the same time and able to destroy each other, able to call others subhuman, vermin, not worthy to live, and have that still also as part of our behavior. Of course, there's a question, is that cultural or is that imprinted? But the argument of two-level selection is that that's deep, that the in-group, out-group divergence of love and affection within the group and hate of the other is two sides of the same coin. And in fact, one depends on the other. But I think that there is a tremendous amount of merit in that view. But it says we harbor within us really a very split human nature. A lot of religions obviously teach that. It's a core to Christian doctrine of original sin. It makes sense from the point of view of the farmer killing the pastoralist in about the earliest days of our species. Those are two different groups competing with each other for similar turf. And the idea that that is a modal behavior of Cain slaying Abel seems also to comport with a lot of observations of human behavior. So I want to talk in conclusion about six hard problems that arise from the biology we carry with us. The biology we carry with us gives us the capacity to cooperate. We have the brain structures that allow us to empathize, that allow us to sympathize, that even may make it the automatic response. We care about reputation desperately. We have reasons to be moral, but we also harbor many limitations in this capacity. And tonight, I don't want to talk about the sociological or political limitations, the creeps that might get into the White House, or the way that a lobbying group may distort the common good. I want to talk about the biological barriers. Tomorrow, when I talk about specific problem solving from a moral point of view, I'm going to talk about some of the political lobbying and economic factors as well. So I would argue that there are six hard problems of morality that mean that even though we grew up in a lot of ways to cooperate, we carry with us a very heavy burden. The more we know it, I think the better off we are, because we can understand where violent impulses, violent emotions, violent tendencies, easy sway can come from. And I'll go through these one by one. One is at the individual level. There are many people, for many reasons, that cannot or do not show a moral response. And there are personality disorders. We may have one as the most powerful person in the world. And it's not meant as a quip or a loose remark. It's meant to scare the wits out of us, which we should be, because there are psychopaths. That is a formal clinical term for a certain kind of personality disorder. It's people who don't have the pathways of guilt, don't have the pathways of interpersonal empathy or sympathy. Maybe they have empathy, but they don't have sympathy. And psychopaths are an identified lot, and they can have very, very high intelligence, very successful manipulative patterns. They can often get their way. They are CEOs and heads of state and in many leading positions throughout history. And they do not fit at all this model from a personality point of view. And that is one fact that should be identified. There are also many other kinds of deviances, addiction disorders, which change brain chemistry and make it impossible for people to behave other than a craving for a particular addiction. There are developmental disorders that come in early childhood. For example, children that grow up in highly stressful environments may lose the capacity for fruitful and productive moral lives in some ways, because they carry biological markers of horrendous abuse from an early age. And this puts a very high premium, especially on care during the brain development period and early childhood development and a nurturing environment to enable individuals to have a healthy development of their brains as well as of their interpersonal relations. And I would say individual deviance probably would not be, it would lead to tragedy of individuals, certainly. It would cause some disarray. The estimate is maybe 1 to 3%, according to some psychologists, have extreme psychopathic disorders. I think the only problem is they shouldn't be president. They shouldn't be Führer. They shouldn't be in positions where they can do profound damage. And so we've had an incredible political failure because a major goal of politics should be to stop crazy people from gaining access to power. I don't know whether the president is crazy, but I know a lot of people who think he is. Crazy is not the right word. Severe personality disorder. One diagnosis is malignant narcissism, which is on a personality spectrum like psychopathy. It's not exactly the same thing, but it's not a good thing. This, I think, raises the question of how many gates and filters are there to power. In general, I don't like presidential systems for this reason. I prefer parliamentary systems. You have more of a gauntlet to get through than running a one-time plebiscite. You generally have colleagues who can control things. It also is a point why we prefer constitutional monarchs to non-constitutional monarchs for the same reason, because lots of deviances can occur on an individual level, and you just don't want that related to power. So a second of these six limits is an obvious basic fact, which is that morality needs to change over time. Morality is not a list of do's and don'ts or a list of taboos and cultural practices. Morality, in my definition, is pro-social behavior. And pro-social behavior changes with technology and changing social organization. But one of the ways that pro-social behavior is enforced in a society is through reputation. One of the ways that reputation is made is that certain dogmas become basic within the society of what is good and bad behavior. And so reading scriptures, repeating the Ten Commandments, repeating various cultural ideas about what is immoral and moral practice, say with regard to sex or with regard to other activities, are ways that morality and reputation are embedded within a society. But societies change. And so we need a way to keep pro-social, not just grounded reputation. And I think that if we have a theory that defines pro-sociality from a more basic point of view of what human beings need for flourishing, and then understand that the situation that human beings find themselves in change over time. Sometimes in the countryside, you're a hunter-gatherer at one point, now you're an agriculturalist. You're an agriculturalist, now you're an industrial worker. You're living in an age before climate change. Now you're living in an age where the level of human activity on fossil fuel use is so great that it wrecks the planet. The norms have to evolve. And that, of course, is what Bentham argued from a utilitarian point of view. But I think this is what it means for economics also to be a science based on moral reasoning, that we have to update what those norms should be from the point of view of a deeper social perspective. One of my favorite quotations of Ed Wilson is this statement, which he's made on a number of occasions, that the real problem of humanity is the following. We have Stone Age emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology. Our societies evolve at different paces. We are not going to change our Stone Age emotions. We may understand them better. We are grounded in our Paleolithic history. That's us. And until some of the the wilder ideas of implanting more synthetic chips in our synapses come to pass, we are what we are. But our more worrisome point is the disjunction between the medieval institutions, which build a lot of the moral fabric, the rules, the behaviors that we set, and the pace of technological change, which remains as fast as ever, I would argue faster than ever. The uptake of new technologies, the diffusion of technology is, in my view, still reaching higher and higher rates of change. Robert Gordon recently has argued that we've got all the low-hanging fruit on technology. I think it's absolutely the opposite. We have the fastest technological change imaginable and possibly runaway technological change. When the computers start giving the lectures, the computers sit in the audience, we can all go to the bar for Valentine's Day and let the computers do the work, but they will have the capacity to evolve even faster than us. So what does that mean? We have new kinds of external damages that we can impose. We couldn't have imposed human-made climate change until basically the late 20th century. And so our ethical behavior is different now, because what was the B or the C is evolving. War is now war that's possible of war of extinction globally. That's a new moral challenge, the nuclear arms challenge. Gender roles, of course, evolve fundamentally in the context of changing technologies, home production, urban versus rural life, and so forth. Sexual mores and taboos obviously are among the strongest moral components. They have a lot to do with the functionality of identifying paternity and maternity and making sure the children and having children be nurtured, and especially for our species, because of the big heads, children emerge needing many, many years of nurturing, and that changes tremendously family and sexual dynamics of human species. But the taboos are very different if there's modern contraception and there's not, except if they're embedded in the scriptures, or even if they're not in the scriptures, if they're imagined in the scriptures somehow. And so things that Jesus could not imagine are put in his mouth every day that have absolutely nothing to do with anything you can find in the Gospels, but they are part of the moral code among certain important moralists. And that, I think, is another example of this disjunction of societal change and true public good and moral precepts. Vendettas and honor killings can make a lot of sense in enforcing good equilibria. That's reciprocal altruism. Except then courts come along, and you really wouldn't like the families just killing each other for the next three generations. But sometimes the word isn't heard in some places in the world, and you still have honor killings, and you still have vendettas and so forth. And that behavior makes a lot of sense from an evolutionary psychological point of view, but it's not pro-social in the same way anymore. Even our what we eat, of course, is completely subject to our biology on the one hand, and the fact that there's food in unlimited amounts at the next corner. And we know that we have a lot of personal behaviors that can kill us in the end because of this lag between the technologies and our moral principles and our behaviors. So that's a second very general point. A third point is morality and power. And this is one of the most important, pervasive ways that moral reasoning fails and that moral principles fail. They fail generally at the top of the power structure of society. And in this, Adam Smith is just wonderful in the theory of moral sentiments because, as I've mentioned on two occasions already, he says, for average people, morals work. it's only for the grandees and the courtiers and the people in aristocratic power that you find the absence of moral behavior. And, of course, Lord Acton is the pithiest of observations and the most powerful, that power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Great men are almost always bad men, said Lord Acton in the 19th century, even when they exercise influence and not authority. Still more when you superadd the tendency of the certainty of corruption by authority. This is a causal link that's being proposed, that having hierarchical dominance leads to a decline of moral behavior. Okay? This is a causal idea. You put a moral person into the White House, they become immoral. You put an immoral person into the White House, God help us. But the idea is that power corrupts. Not that powerful people are corrupt or that they self-selected, but that power corrupts. That's a theory, and I want to talk a little bit about that theory. One of my favorite sociologists, the founder of the sociology department of Harvard University in 1921, Peturim Sorokin, came from Russia and studied the morality of powerful people. He studied the behavior of the English royal families, for example, and showed that just about all of them were murderers and pretty pervasively. He studied the behavior of American CEOs and found that most of them were crooks, murderers, or just simply insane. He followed the behavior of U.S. governors. He basically followed the logic of Lord Acton and found that most people in power are bad people, and that this isn't just wringing our hands and bemoaning. This is an observable, measurable trait. So a summary of a wonderful book that he published in 1959 is the following. The moral behavior of ruling groups tends to be more criminal and submoral than that of the ruled strata in the same society. He looked at homicide rates among the powerful and homicide rates on average. And the homicide rates of people in power are sometimes almost 100%, but very, very high, whereas these homicide rates in general are much lower. Then a second point, the greater, more absolute and coercive the power of the rulers, political leaders, and big executives, and the less freely this power is approved by the ruled population, the more corrupt and criminal such ruling groups tend to be. So this is another empirical claim. And then finally, with the progressive limitation of their power, criminality of rulers and executives tends to decrease qualitatively and quantitatively. So this is a causal theory. Lord Acton is not just a clever quip. It is a causal theory. And one of the possibilities is neurobiological pathways, including testosterone, because the testosterone hormone is very much associated with aggressive behavior. And it's quite interesting, I was reading studies of this in preparation for this, that events like winning an election boost the testosterone. Not only of the winners, by the way, but of people who have campaigned for the winners as well. And so what happens with testosterone is that moments of hierarchical dominance success, winning games, winning competition, winning battles, winning wars, gives a boost to testosterone, which in turn has been associated with aggressive male behavior. And the idea is that this is one of the biological pathways that can make seriously this idea of power corrupting. This is Adam Smith. I just thought I would end with that. One of the problems of controlling powerful people is that we tend to admire powerful people. And that's also built into our behavior. And Smith said that this was a big problem because they're louts. So we shouldn't admire them. They lack moral virtues. They lack moral behavior. Power has corrupted them. But we can't help but admire them. And that is a weakness that Smith noted that perhaps also has its evolutionary roots in male hierarchical dominance in societies. But Smith says the great mob of mankind are the admirers and worshipers, and what may seem more extraordinary, most frequently, the disinterested admirers and worshipers of wealth and greatness. And so we look on those who behave very badly, and this is the opposite of what is needed to enforce moral behavior within the society. Now, there have been a number of recent studies that test this kind of corruptibility, and I wanted to mention a couple of them to you because they're quite fascinating. One is a look at the culture within Wall Street. And the way this was done was quite ingenious. It's not exactly power and corruption, but it's close. A major bank, unidentified in the Nature 2014 article, was tested with the group of employees randomly allocated between a control group and a treatment group. In the control group, in both groups, subjects flipped a coin 10 times and reported how many heads they got in the 10 flips. They weren't observed, they just reported. They were told the more heads you get, the more money you will win in an award in this process. And they wrote down the number and submitted it. Random allocation of the subjects, so it's the same group randomly allocated. In the control group, the subjects were given a questionnaire: how many children do you have, do you have siblings, what's your favorite sport, and so forth. In the treatment group, the questionnaire said, what is your position in the bank? What do you think about international banking? And it was a number of priming questions, so-called, to get people to put their minds into their banking role. That's the only difference, otherwise randomized allocation. So the treatment group flipped the coin, and they reported 50.5% heads in their flip. All the flips were combined, and that actually was within the confidence band, given the size of the treatment group, of randomness at 50%. When those who were primed to think as bankers flipped the coins, they reported 58.5% heads. And this is a p-value of less than 0.00001 of a random honest coin flip leading to 58.5% heads. In other words, bankers are cheaters when they think of themselves as bankers. And all that the difference was the priming of a questionnaire. At the end of the study, they were asked a question, or they were asked a number of questions, but one of them was, how important is money to social status? Mind you, random allocation. The control group said, not very important. The banking primed group said, quite important. And so this is how easily we can be shifted in our moral behavior by a, perhaps it relates to either the culture of the industry or the sense of power that attaches to it. A related study, absolutely wonderful, in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, did 7 little experiments, I won't repeat all of them, and looked at the moral behavior or pro-social behavior against socioeconomic status. So, and this is by PIF, PNAS, I think also, I think 2011, but I don't remember, I apologize. But in these 7 tests, I'll just give you a flavor of a couple of them. One was just observational, the four stop signs at an intersection, and they measured whether the more expensive car would go first through the intersection. So it's like a game of chicken in a dyadic game theory. And there was a very strong tendency for those who were driving the more expensive car to be the first through the intersection. In the second game, they looked at whether the car would stop for the pedestrian or would shoot ahead of the pedestrian. And again, the richer the car, the more you tried to knock over the pedestrian, or actually just you tried to make your way first before the pedestrian. In this fourth game, very simple, subjects were given a little psychological test, which was just a decoy test, and then told, thank you very much. By the way, on your way out, would you take this candy to the children in across the way? And they were told, you can have some if you want. And then they measured how many pieces of candy were taken against socioeconomic status. The richer the people, the more candy they took for themselves, and the less they left for the children that they delivered. Then there was a wonderful game of electronically rolling dice. So you were told, roll these dice. I think it was on an electronic screen. Roll them three times. Report the sum. The higher the sum, the more you're going to earn. Like the coin flipping test, in this case, of course, the system was programmed that the sum of the three rolls would always add to 12. The subjects didn't know that, of course. So the richer, the higher the socioeconomic status, the higher the report, well above 12, reporting this. So lots of evidence that higher SES, higher socioeconomic status, richer people have less pro-social behavior, more antisocial behavior. And what exactly the roots of that are, whether that's what biological pathways or other pathways, I think needs to be understood better. But the combination of observed behavior of the political class, of CEOs, of Wall Street, of socioeconomic status gives us a lot of reason to worry about the people at the top of the curve. And I would say that Lord Acton's hypothesis that power corrupts is a very active, good hypothesis. It fits the observed data. It's causal. It's meant to be causal. And to the extent that's true, that, of course, has a lot of implications about controlling power. The next hard problem is gender, because gender inequality is probably deeply built in to human nature. And the predominant theory of this and theorizer of this is Richard Wrangham and colleagues at Harvard. This is a famous book called The Demonic Male that was written now 20 years ago. But the idea is that our closest animal relative is the chimpanzee. We share, our common, most recent common ancestor is with the chimpanzee dividing off about 6 million years ago. Chimpanzees are highly hierarchical, patriarchal, male-dominant communities that have a lot of underlying characteristics with observed human societies. As Wrangham argues, both chimpanzee and human societies display male hierarchical violence, male violence against females, and murder raids on outgroups. So strong in-group, out-group differentiation, but very strong gender differentiation. Males are not subordinated in rank to females, and there's a tremendous amount of gratuitous male violence for dominance, war, rape, and murder. I'm not going to say more about this because we discuss these issues a lot, but I would say that the issues of gender equality do not come easily. And I would argue from not just one slide, but from a lot of evidence in our societies that these differences are not cultural imprints merely. They're cultural imprints that reflect deep biological imprints as well. And they are huge problems for human well-being and for human well-being of half of the population. A fifth problem that I think is a very deep one is how to sustain reputational equilibria. Because reputation depends on people taking the cues from reputation. And reputation that people do not follow, or reputational norms that are not followed, cannot sustain reputation-based equilibria. So if we're depending on moral behavior by us wanting to have good reputations because we behave morally, but our society doesn't believe in that kind of behavior as being realistic or moral, then as a society we lose the chance to have moral principles upheld through reputational equilibria. Think of a country where the game is to evade taxes. That's a lot of countries in the world. Not all countries. In some countries, the rate of tax-paying compliance is extremely high. In other countries, the rate of tax-paying compliance is extremely low. Often countries that have been under colonial rule, a lot of the post-Ottoman countries, and it's not just post-Ottoman, it's a lot of post-colonial countries, had built in a process of doing anything to evade paying tribute or taxation to a colonial overseer. And once the colonial period ends, the post-colonial governments have a very hard time establishing a norm of tax honesty. And I would argue that that is a kind of contagious norm, which is that if nobody's paying their taxes and you proclaim you're paying your tax, that's not building a reputation for anything other than foolishness. And that means that you lose the ability to get the pro-social outcomes of public goods. So think of public goods as the N-person prisoner's dilemma, where everybody has to put in something. And if there's no opprobrium attached to not contributing, then you live in a society without the public goods. This is a huge reality in the world. And the argument I would make is that it's a hard problem because you can easily see how you can have multiple equilibria in which there are societies that are non-trusting societies and where reputation doesn't support the good outcomes. And then there are other societies that, for whatever historical process, behave according to law. Behaving according to law gives a good reputation, and a good reputation then is sustained with good behavior. I think it's an extraordinarily important problem. Tax evasion's not a joke. Cynicism is not an answer. Cynicism is perhaps an accurate view of a reality in a country, but the whole point I'm trying to make is that bad outcomes have high costs, and merely being cynical, that's how people are, is a self-fulfilling prophecy. And that's why we need moralizers in society to say that's wrong. And somehow, if societies are stuck in a low-level equilibrium where bad behavior is not moralized, we have a very, very serious problem. It's not just that the cynics have won, it's that the good outcomes have been forfeited. Final point is intergroup violence. And as I've mentioned, this is really the darkest side of humanity. It is our easy capacity to hate others. And it's part of our clear psychological makeup, our incredible capacity to create identities, to join groups, to find groups that have absolutely no intrinsic source, but create a camaraderie because they are defined as groups. There are hundreds of experiments now of creating artificial groups. You divide people in a classroom, children in a classroom, or people in an office by whether your license plate ends in odd or even, and by the end of the day, they hate each other. Or you divide them whether they're wearing solid color shirts or plaid shirts, and you tell them they're two different groups. You divide people whether they like Kandinsky or don't like Kandinsky. And the capacity on these very superficial ways to create in-group bonding and out-group disapprobrium is remarkable. And so just as we carry within us powerful capacities of moral behavior, we carry tremendously powerful capacities of hate, and especially not individual hate, intergroup hate. And it can be absolutely sensible to say, oh, my best friend is so-and-so. I don't hate X, Y, and Z. I have plenty of friends. That's not the point. The point is our capacity as members of a group to have out-group sentiments, not as individuals, but as members of a group. And this is, Rangam went on the demonic male model after it was discovered that all that the chimpanzee scientist, Goodall, Jane Goodall, had written about the wonderful loving chimpanzees in Gonde, Tanzania, and then close observers were one day surprised to watch them beat the crap out of another chimpanzee and kill him because it was from a different troop. And then they started to watch and they said, my God, they're at war. And the males, when they found them, watched them carefully, were on a long expedition of territorial protection. And if somebody from another group wandered in to that territory, they were very likely to get killed. And then it was discovered that male chimpanzees would make these war raids that I mentioned on an earlier slide to go in and bash the brains out of the males of other groups. So the loving species turned out to be a little bit more complicated. And it turned out that the out-group behavior was very powerful. And Rangam created the chimpanzee model as a model of basic human nature. E.O. Wilson has created the campsite model. The question comes back to whether group-level selection is likely and possible. And it isn't possible when the group is mixing so much that reproductive success does not really depend on what's happening within a group. So what Wilson has argued is that what makes for high levels of cooperation are species that protect a home base. That could be the beehive. That could be the wasp hive. That could be, what he says for humans, the campsite, because that's our primordial home base. In the hunter-gatherer period of 2 million B.C. up to Homo sapiens, it was the campsite, and it was that band, and it was defending that territory, claims Wilson, that gave the base for group-level selection. And what Wilson pointed out very controversially was the old argument that bees and wasps and ants are eusocial, meaning highly social, because they share genes among half-sibs by, say, a queen bee, what's called haploid-diploid sharing of. He says that is actually not determinative of high-level sociality, because there are many species that have that half-gene sharing but are not eusocial. What makes these particular species eusocial is they have hives. And that's what makes them social, that they're protecting an area, and that allows for intergroup selection to take place. And so this is really horrible, because our biggest problems are not inter-individual violence, but intergroup violence. The big deaths, massacres, slaughters are one group against another, not the homicides within the society, though men kill a lot of women in society. The organized violence is intergroup, whether it's interethnic, interstate, now intergang. And it obviously invokes, it has to do with politics, so it has to do with power at the top. It has to do with our susceptibility to storylines. It has to do with intergroup hatred. And it is certainly, in my view, the most damning and worrisome part of our human nature and the biggest obstacle to moral behavior that we face. There are many important studies of this. One is this wonderful experiment in a camp of young kids by a social psychologist named Muzaffer Sharif. It's called the Robber's Cave experiment because it was Robber's Cave camp. And what he did is the campers came in, I think they're about 10-year-olds, he divided them into two groups, two cabins. One, he said, you're the Rattlers. The other, you're the Eagles. He created group identity. By the second week, they were hating each other, and things were getting out of hand. And then in the next phase, he established intergroup cooperation to solve what became known in this literature as superordinate problems, problems that required cooperation beyond a group identity. And by the end of the experiment, was able to dissipate what had been an out-of-control process of intergroup conflict. We're living through Brexit. We're living through Donald Trump. I view these phenomena as having a tremendous amount to do, not with economic hardship so much as with migration and interethnic problems. And I thought one of the wonderful reports was a focus group work in the United States trying to understand the anti-immigrant attitudes of the American Midwest, which became Trump's stronghold. And it says one of the most prominent themes from the middle-class Euro focus group, which is a white American European descent focus group, was the symbolic importance of language as a means of defining membership in the community. English language proficiency was perceived not as a skill, but as the reflection of core American values by the middle-class Euro-Americans. The implication is that immigrants voluntarily chose whether or not to speak English, and that this choice indicates acceptance of American mores and the desire to be integrated into U.S. society. Extraordinarily naive, but extraordinarily powerful. You don't speak right. You're not respecting me. And that is how easy the intergroup conflict is to lead to the kind of problems that we are facing. And I'll end this evening with an absolutely horrible, frightening, realistic, chilling interview, famous interview of Hermann Göring, one of the leading Nazis who gave this interview in Nuremberg jail during the Nuremberg trials. And it's about war. And Göring says, why, of course, the people don't want war. Why would some poor slob on a farm want to risk his life in a war when the best that he can get out of it is to come back to his farm in one piece? Naturally, the common people don't want war, neither in Russia, nor in England, nor in America, nor, for that matter, in Germany. That is understood. But after all, it is the leaders of the country who determine the policy, and it is always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it is a democracy or a fascist dictatorship or a parliament or a communist dictatorship. His interviewer says there is one difference. In a democracy, the people have some say in the matter through their elected representatives. And in the United States, only Congress can declare war. That was a long time ago. And then Göring answers, oh, that is all well and good, but voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them they are being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same way in any country. And that's how we went to the Iraq War. Britain, it was a little bit different. You went to the Iraq War because you do what the United States says. That was a very big mistake. But how easy it is to go to war. And that, I believe, is the reflection of this in-group, out-group behavior. How easy it is to invoke patriotism. How easy it is to say you're being attacked by the other. So morality is not simple. We have it in us to be good. We have it in us to be bad. Tomorrow night, I'm going to argue that we have it in us to solve some big problems. Thank you very much.
Jeff, that was terrific, and you can see what people felt. Now, very shortly, we're going to have a reception. Also, our wonderful supporters in red here have got to go off at 8 o'clock, which is already 8:05. So, I propose to ask for five questions.
Five yes-no questions.
Each question is a maximum of two sentences. And Jeff will then answer them, and we will then go and have a drink, and you can ask him some questions on your own. Five questions. Here's one.
Yeah.
Two sentences.
Sorry about my glasses.
Yeah, yeah.
A person with a brain injury, a child who's been abused as a kid and suffers an injury or something doesn't develop properly, is that person immoral, or is that a person with an injury?
Next question.
Here.
Yeah.
Maybe more of a personal kind. You talked about power corrupting. In my mind... Whoops.
In the middle.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, okay.
In my mind, you two are very powerful people. How does that sort of manifest on a personal level? I never asked anyone that question, that's why.
Here. Upstairs.
Right, okay.
Let's have that person right at the back there.
No, I have it here.
Yes.
Yeah. Hi.
There's a lady. There's a lady at the back there.
But I'm Mexican. We can just wait here forever.
I just had a question. You mentioned briefly gender inequality and violence against women. Do you think that that's a commentary on willingness to cooperate and morality between genders or something else?
Yeah.
In the back here.
Hi. I mean, it's discrimination against Mexican again. Yeah, I'm just kidding. Yeah, so my question is, I'm actually interested in seeing the way that you would respond. You as an American citizen, within all these problems, would you be willing to apologize to Mexico and to Mexicans? Thank you.
Me?
Okay, right at the back.
Hi, thanks. Mr. Sachs, if this is human nature, shall we change human nature genetically?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Good. Okay, great. I think a person with brain lesions, and there are many recorded incredible cases, you would say that they may be incapable of moral reasoning. Oh, there's a very famous interesting case of a man named, I think it's Phineas Cage, who shockingly was putting an explosive mining or laying a rail, and the rod went right through his head, and he survived fully and was fully functional and was incapable of many interpersonal things, but he was very irascible after that and had a big hole in his head, actually, but was able to function. So his behavior was fundamentally changed. There are brain pathways for theory of mind, for moral behavior, for emotional sentiments, and when there are lesions on those, then what we would regard as sympathy, empathy, or ability to follow moral principles can obviously no longer follow. And so in that sense, the behaviors that we would say are moral behaviors are defeated by the brain lesions. Those are organic cases. There are a lot of them recorded in studies. Has power corrupted on a personal level? I haven't had the full joy to find out. No one's offered me a great bribe. And I think I hope not. I think the kind of power that you may have, if you call it power, in influence to the extent that you have it, first is somewhat fleeting and always a bit flimsy. It doesn't lead itself to too much. Well, it can. I've never taken pay from a government to say some wonderful thing about a government. Yeah.
Yeah. In academia, and I mean, coming out at the top, you must feel like the people in, for example, Silicon Valley, who think basically I made it up here, so my sense of self-value must be above other people, right? Is that one of the mechanisms, or how does that come? Like, where does that come from?
I think that it can be. I don't think it has to be. I hope it isn't, but of course you can use a profession to do many things, to aim to get rich, to aim to get powerful positions, and to misuse that ability. I felt for me that. Having been lucky to get tenure early on, I felt it was more of a privilege that made a certain responsibility, basically to try to be as accurate as possible. That's how I've always understood my situation, that I'm in the lucky position that they can't fire me for telling the truth. I think. I've always behaved more or less on that basis. And I've always taken that to be the privilege, that truth-telling should be my particular strong suit, or truth-telling in the best way I can do it, because I'm in the lucky position where I don't depend on somebody not liking it. It's by the way, it's really hard always to tell the truth, even aside from the white lie kind of things that it's just unpleasant and rude. I'm talking about really being honest, because we live in social webs, and if you're trying to help someone and then you tell the truth about someone else and they have their own relationships, you can make very complicated problems. And so this is not an easy problem, but I've always taken the privilege of tenure to be specifically the privilege of being able to tell the truth, because you're not on the pay of a particular interest and you don't worry about being fired the next day for violating someone's power structure. And I've tested that on a couple of occasions. So far they haven't fired me, but I've spoken often against very powerful people, and I've been shaken down by powerful people. On occasion, it's extraordinarily unpleasant. It's really frightening. I've been shaken down in the most exalted sites in the U.S. government, and I didn't like it at all. And I was afraid, and I remember going and called my wife from the lobby of one of our departments, and I said I was just threatened by one of the most powerful people in the country, threatened, which I was. And I was a blob of sweat really a wreck. And then I calmed down a little bit. I remember it was still a payphone. I had to put a quarter in the phone in Washington to call Boston. And I thought, I don't think they'll knock me off with a sniper, and they can't get me fired. And so I calmed down. And it became true that I survived that episode, even though it was frightening. Violence against women, I think that it is who asked the question? I think that it is a lot individual, because a lot of the behavior is not intergroup violence, and it's not violence against women in other groups, though that's very frequent, that in raiding parties constantly, the victorious armies rape all the women before putting them into slavery or claiming them as wives or slaves afterwards. But this is violence within the household, and that's just pervasive across societies. And in a lot of societies till today, women can't do anything about it. And if they try to do something about it, the police laugh at them or report back to the husband, or the husband is so ashamed that he kills the wife or throws acid in her face, or the brothers humiliate the husband. So this is quite deep. And, of course, one can associate it with cultures, particular cultures, but I think that it is really something quite deep. I'm with Rangam on this, that we probably trace this back to pretty basic instinctual behavior. And that kind of genetic behavior can be overcome if it's understood, or through habit formation, learning, mentoring, and so forth. But it's probably pretty deep and pretty deep a tendency. It's not in... It's not just deviant behavior. It's probably normal behavior in some sense that is horrible in outcome and that has to be made deviant through cultural recognition. With Mexico, I just want to make sure that I can come to the other side of the wall if I need to. You know, it's a disgrace what Trump is doing. And Trump is acting like a standard kind of demagogue, which is taking real grievance and blaming it on foreigners, or blaming it on misdirecting the blame. American society, there's nothing wrong with it that wouldn't be fixed by some really good income distribution from the rich to the poor, and some limits on the power of CEOs, and some crackdown on criminality on Wall Street, and stopping the campaign contributions that make the Koch brothers the owner of the U.S. Congress. So the basic mechanics are understandable, but of course what Trump is selling is that the problem is the Mexicans. The thing that made you worse off is the Chinese. It's the Mexicans. It's the most standard ploy of blaming others. It's the Muslims. And so we actually have almost a classic classic case of this kind of demagoguery, and it's quite dangerous, absolutely dangerous. Then the last question I wrote, shall we... What was it? Yeah. Sorry, remind me.
We should change human nature genetically.
Oh, should it? Sorry, I didn't even get that far. The computer stopped me from writing that. I was at a meeting of artificial intelligence leaders a couple of weeks ago. They weren't talking so much about implanting chips and cyborg ideas, but about the fact that machine learning is advancing so quickly that basically the machines will be able to do our part for us I think that I don't know whether that's the real worry or not, but I'm kind of a bit worried about that. I think changing human nature, we would probably do better to try to understand ourselves first and try to understand our weak sides and live with them through institutional, social, mentoring, education, to try to have a more complete, satisfying, healthy lives that understand where we can go wrong. Even if our societies understood how easy it is to be prejudicial and had some of the examples of intergroup violence, not a one-time boring lecture, but as an integrated idea, we would, I think, demoralize the racism that often is moralized in a lot of societies. It took a long time with the civil rights movement in the United States. It did not end racism, but it did make it socially unacceptable, visibly. Even if it's lightly disguised sometimes, it's quite different from 20 or 30 or 40 years ago from a normative point of view. What are moral principles and social precepts? And I do think it's behaviorally different from the kind of situation we had in the United States, for example, in the 1960s, when it was perfectly normal to put dogs and police hoses on African Americans and kill and lynch and burn African Americans, burn alive. I think the situation is quite different from that. So it's an example of changing our ideas even when the human nature remains the same. I think Gandhi made a fundamental contribution to the world in this regard also, of changing ideas about colonialism. His great line about Western civilization, when he was asked what he thought of Western civilization, and he said it should be tried, he thought it would be a good idea. The demoralization, demoralizing of what we understand to be our tendencies towards violence, bigotry, hatred, is a real process that can work. But it takes self-understanding, and it takes societies opening up to understanding. And that's why I think moral preaching is actually quite important. But I'm not sure that what we hear preached by most of our moral figures is really about these issues very much. In the United States, most of what we hear about moral preaching is about sexual taboos rather than about these kinds of issues. I think that education is going to be a lot more powerful than neurosurgery that implants clever chips and a lot safer, because I'm not sure who I would ever want to be deciding those choices of fundamentally altering human nature.
Jeff, you've given us a terrific survey today of all the problems, and it's great that you've got your third lecture to give us all the answers. So we're really looking forward to that. Somebody asked what it is like to be a well-placed economist, and I would like to say that I know a lot of well-placed economists whose prime motivation is definitely to improve the world. Among those, I can't think of anybody, any economist, who has done more to improve the world than Jeff, and I really mean that. Jeff, I just admire what you have done so much. It's quite amazing. We haven't even mentioned the Millennium Goals, which is one of your greatest achievements. So let us say thank you, Jeff. Thank you.